Hey, good morning, everyone. Welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the radio show for frustrated people to discover how to fix this mess. Today, we're going to be talking about racial justice, among other things. But first, it's March 16th, and that means it's Lip Appreciation Day. So that's a great day to get to admire and be thankful for lips and appreciate them. They're a wonderful part of our anatomy. So check us out at www.underaffiliated.com, and that's where we capture this show, as well as some insights about some of the things we're learning as we go through this journey on the show. Today, we have Diana Sierra, who's the Chief Executive Officer at the YWCA of Asheville and Western North Carolina. And welcome, Diana. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your organization?
Good morning. I'm really happy to spend a little bit of time with you all this morning. As Eric said, my name is Diana Sierra. My pronouns are she, her, ella, and I am the CEO at the YWCA of Asheville in Western North Carolina. I have been in that role for 2.5 years and proudly serving our community with an amazing team. To talk a little bit about our organization, the YWCA of Asheville, our mission is to eliminate racism, empower women, and promote peace, justice, freedom, and dignity for all. We are 116 years old. We've been serving the Asheville community since 1907, always centered around racial equity, gender equity, and all kinds of social justice issues. One thing I really like to talk about when I talk about the YWCA is we have lots of different programs. We actually have 8 different programs that serve our community in different ways. All of our programs work to advance racial justice, empower women, promote health, and nurture children. So really, really happy to be here with you all.
So what's going on? What are you focusing on that we ought to talk about today?
Absolutely. So first off, happy Women's History Month. We're in the thick of it, and we're doing a lot of programming and awareness building around the role that women play, both in our history and in our current politics and economy. So just really focusing on that this month, though we celebrate that every day of the year. But we've got some really exciting things coming up when it comes to our racial justice work. We are doing our annual Until Justice Just Is, which is formerly known as our Stand Against Racism, which is an annual campaign that we do in partnership with YWUSA, where it's designed to build community awareness around the important work of racial justice and equity in our community. And so this is an annual campaign which provides the opportunity for communities across the United States to find an issue or a cause that inspires them and to unite their voices to educate and advocate and promote racial justice. And so this can be done in a variety of ways. That can be done by hosting your own event, joining us for a viewing party. We're actually doing a viewing party at the YW, which is a great way to build community and be in partnership with folks that share similar values. And there's
is that a specific event, one day event or something where people can come and join you and participate in that?
So it's actually a month long. It's a month long series of events that happens across the nation. And the hope is that our community would galvanize and host their own events throughout the month.
What do we need to be aware of as a community to galvanize around?
Absolutely. That's a great question. There's lots of areas that we focus on, but when we talk about equity, we really try to focus on our kind of key programmatic focuses, which is health and wellness, specifically racial disparities as it relates to health outcomes. We talk a lot about the child care crisis that we're in and how there's lack of affordable and equitable and high quality child care. And we know that that disproportionately impacts lower income folks, women, single mothers, and folks that are from the BIPOC community. We also do a lot of awareness and advocacy around just our economic infrastructure and the fact that women and BIPOC folks make less to the dollar. We just celebrated just this week, you know, Equal Pay Day, and the fact that women make less money than men for the same work. And so all of our programs are designed to both have an advocacy component, but also work with the individuals that are impacted by these disparities.
Explain a little bit for folks kind of the foundation, why these are real issues, economic opportunity issues, childcare issues, there's these disparities. I think that that's not necessarily a new message, but let's level set about why those are issues.
Absolutely. So I think it's important to zoom out and look at, and part of the Until Justice Justice campaign is really looking at structural and institutional racism, and looking at, and we talk a lot about this in our free racial justice workshops that we provide for the community. We talk a lot about how our systems were actually created to advantage some folks based on race and the color of their skin and disadvantage other folks. And so when we live and are born in a system that advantages folks based on their race and the color of their skin, if we're enjoying those privileges and enjoying those advantages, it's sometimes difficult to see how we're benefiting from that. And, you know, we have an American way of thinking that we can pick ourselves up from our bootstraps. As an immigrant to this country, I'm the first generation born here in the States. We were taught that in America, you can pick yourself up from your bootstraps. Well, when you zoom out, what happens when you don't have boots, when you don't have those opportunities, when you have decades and centuries long institutions and systems that are actually actively disadvantaging you? And so it's important for us to slow down and think about how all of this is kind of baked into our societal cake.
So I noticed that you have this upcoming, is it the racial justice week or is it the whole month? But there's voting, there's education, there's criminal justice and public health. Those are the things that you're talking about. A lot of people, white people, assume you can get the American dream by picking you up from your bootstraps, but that's not true for BIPOC people. Fair?
Generally, yeah.
Okay, so then, if you wouldn't mind, could you go through how voting and the education pipeline and the criminal justice and public health work together to create that scenario that you're talking about? I think that would help folks really get in their head around why what you say may be true.
At the end of the day, and so just to kind of zoom out to the Racial Justice Challenge, this is an opportunity for community members to participate in a process where they investigate four different topics, one topic per week. They'll by registering, this is a free challenge, they will get curated content sent to their email focusing on disability, housing, mental health, and music. The topics change each challenge. But this is an opportunity for, as you were saying, for us to educate ourselves on doing kind of a deeper dive in each of those topics and why those disparities exist, and to really learn about what our history is in those areas. And so to go back to your question about what's at the root and the foundation of this, we at the YW really fundamentally believe that it starts with us gaining the historical context, us learning the facts and the information around how we got to where we are, and really working towards what it means to be an anti-racist and creating an anti-racist society, which involves addressing racism in ourselves and in the systems that promote these disparities.
Take one of the topics and explain, tell me the story, the history, as you said, that I need to get this.
Sure. Yeah. So something that we talk a fair amount about in our racial justice workshops is education. And education for us in Asheville is really important because we know that the opportunity gap in our educational system is one of the worst in the nation here in Asheville. We're the worst in North Carolina, and we're the fifth worst in the nation. That's something that a lot of folks don't realize, that our education system is really struggling, and it's not due to lack of resources.
What's the measure for that?
It's multi-pronged, but test scores and promotion to the next grade level, are students leaving their public school education ready to be successful either in higher education or in seeking a career? So there's a gap between how white students are performing and how BIPOC students are performing. And the reason why we call it a gap is because really the gap starts in the gap in resources. We actually spend in Asheville and in Buncombe County, the cost per student is actually very competitive. So one can't argue that we're not allocating enough money to our education system comparatively to other school systems. It's really the people that make the institutions that then creates the gap. So when we talk about the education gap, we kind of break it down to the resources that are allocated to schools, how each individual student is engaged and treated. So I have worked in the education system, not here in Western North Carolina, but in New York City. You can have a white student who has some behavioral challenges, and oftentimes they're afforded a lot more grace, a lot more support, a lot more opportunity, versus a black or brown student might be labeled as a troubled kid, or they're, you know, quote, a bad kid, and they're penalized and punished for their behavior and not given the support. It goes to the stories that we teach in terms of our history, what figures we learn about throughout our educational experience, field trips, down to the policies and the practices. So it's something that it's not just one, you know, one string that we pull. It's a multi-pronged set of resources and ways of approaching that are reflected of our prejudices that create this gap.
I just want to add one thing again from my personal experience. It's also who you know and who you're connected to. So I know I also grew up in a relatively affluent white neighborhood or surroundings, and I remember the distinction of parents being able to say, oh, poor Johnny, he ran in with the wrong crowd, or he had a bad day, or very easily excusing it. And then you would hear the same story about another child in a BIPOC environment, and you would it would be like exactly what you said. Immediately a negative connotation instead of, oh, the poor kid, we need to help him.
Right. So, right. And that's all rooted in our individual prejudices. Prejudice, we all have prejudices, and prejudices serve us in some capacity. They sometimes, being able to assess a situation can allow us to make certain decisions that keeps us, you know, safe. But when we act on those prejudices based on race, and then we have the power and resources to impact someone else's experience, that's how we at the YW define racism. So prejudice plus power equals racism. And so when we talk about the education system, we have situation after situation that compounded creates this gap, this disparity.
Do you think it's possible that social determinants of health over time, the history, have made racism even worse? If you're talking about when kids come to school with potential quote unquote behavioral problems, that could be by trauma in your neighborhood. There could be these other factors that are exacerbating racism to begin with. Is that something that has crossed your mind?
Yeah, I mean, that's crossed my mind. I think it goes both ways. I think the social determinants to health that the BIPOC community has to navigate every day creates disparities in all these other areas outside of health, in education, in earning power, in social capital, and other areas. And there, it goes the other way in terms of those challenges that BIPOC folks are having to navigate also impact their health. So there's a lot of research that promotes this idea that racism actually makes specifically Black folks' lifespan shorter. There's a lot of research out there. Recently listened to a TED Talk that we carry this trauma, this racial trauma in our bodies, and that does impact our health. That does impact our ability to navigate different systems. And, you know, just to kind of close the loop a little bit on the education conversation, you know, we know inherently that Black and brown students are just as capable as white students. But when you compound all of these factors that we're talking about, the outcomes would say otherwise. And the challenge with that is that actually promotes, for some folks, that can promote their own prejudices around academic achievement across races. And so it's actually this vicious cycle that we have to work to dismantle and really kind of pull each thread to change the tide. Exactly. We're creating this reality that's made from a narrative we have in our minds that goes back centuries.
So when you talk about the systemic racism, where would you want to focus to begin to change?
I mean, we believe that at the YW, we believe it starts, you know, at birth. And that's why we have, you know, one of the largest child care centers in Buncombe County. We believe in giving kiddos a very strong, rich start one where they are empowered, where they can come with the traumas or challenges that they're navigating and be in a safe and nurturing environment, and where they go into kindergarten ready for school. And so we put so much emphasis when we talk about the education system, we talk about it starting at kindergarten, but it really starts in early learning programs where kiddos are learning how to be socialized with other kids. They're learning pre-literacy skills. They're learning how to learn through play. They're learning self-regulation, self-soothing. All of those skills start at infancy. And if we can give them a solid start, that's going to make them that much more resilient and set up for success when they go into kindergarten. There's data out there that talks about expulsion rates in childcare centers. So we're talking about kiddos that are predominantly Black and brown being expelled from childcare centers. We're talking about 2-, 3-, and 4-year-olds being labeled. And so one of the ways we're focusing on that as an organization is really trying to have a trauma-informed, high-quality childcare program that focuses on education and holistic wellness for the child and support for the families, really, really trying to meet families where they're at.
And I think one of the things, too, is if other children see that children that don't look like them are getting that kind care, that helps to build their empathy and limit their maybe inclination to pick up bad assumptions or...
Absolutely. A lot of the white families, so right now, I just looked at the data this morning, 60% of our childcare children, the children in our early learning program are white, 40% are BIPOC, which is not reflective of our community. There's way more white folks than that. But I do believe that for a lot of the families that choose to bring their children to the YW's early learning program, it's because they want to bring their kiddos to a diverse environment where they can be with kiddos that reflect our entire community, both racially, ethnically, and socioeconomically. Right? Because we take childcare subsidies. So we serve lower income families that qualify for this subsidy. And so being in an environment where your children can see everybody and learn about Black history and women's history and create that diverse community is really important.
Have BIPOC friends, meet their parents.
Absolutely.
What are the challenges you see in helping young people have more of an open aperture about race?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you ask that question, the first reaction that came to my mind is that children have a rich appetite for diversity and for engaging in conversations around equity. I spend a lot of time engaging with families and parents, and there's a theme, a lot of children get stuck on fairness and what's fair for them and what's fair for others at an early, early age. And I think that's a natural springboard to talk about equity. I actually think that children have in some ways a better capacity to understand the principles of equity and of diversity. But when we don't support that and when we don't contain that in a way that really guides children to get the importance of racial equity, we educate them away from that. And that's all socialization. No one's born inherently prejudiced or having discriminatory actions or thoughts or beliefs towards other races. All of that is how we create this container and socialize kiddos.
I kind of think about being a kid, and there was a time when it's like, yeah, what's fair? When does that go away? How can we start to think about fixing it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes away slowly over time. I think it's actually chipped away at. It's eroded. Lots of different interactions through content that we allow our kiddos to consume in terms of media, cartoons, conversations they have with parents, interactions that are allowed or not allowed in their classrooms, and ways in which we justify very subtle and minute forms of racism and bullying. But I don't think that there is a reality or there's a world where that doesn't have to go away. And I get the privilege of facilitating the YW's co-facilitating the YW's racial justice workshops. We do those every month for free. They're virtual. There are three different 90-minute sessions where we talk about this. We talk about racial justice. We talk about disparities in Asheville. And a lot of parents come, and I have the privilege of being in community with folks who are doing the active work of cultivating that in their kiddos. And it's really, really inspiring. And what they're doing is taking the time to have those conversations, exposing them to books and content and stories and history and facts that really promote this idea that it takes all of us to have the community that we want to have. And it takes active undoing of what their kiddos are learning when they're not with their parents, because, you know, kids learn from every experience that they're having in their world. It just takes a level of intention. But I don't think, to answer your question, I don't think it has to go away, that idea of fairness that kiddos have and that openness to new people.
I think that there are some people who get this idea about diversity, inclusion, and equity, and they teach their kids those values. What about everybody else who's kind of, this is just woke culture, and who's just like, okay, kind of rolling their eyes about this? How do we address that? Maybe folks who don't think about this, they may see representations of BIPOC and pop in the culture as woke and roll their eyes, and they don't even know. It's just what they hear. How do we begin to change that?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And that is the exact space we want to be as an organization. We want to be in community with folks who are willing to go on this journey with us. I think it starts with not being divisive. I think it starts with what we're doing right here, right now, getting people to the table and talking about these issues, being in relationship and creating opportunities where with love and kindness and respect, we can share our experiences. We can debate politics and can debate our opinions all day, but it's really hard to debate an experience that I share vulnerably with you as a Latina navigating this world. There's power in us talking about our experiences. And even for folks that, for white folks and folks that don't share a BIPOC racial identity, there are ways in which we can start to understand that there are identities that we have that give us privilege, and there are identities that we have that take away our privilege and disadvantage us. I think a lot about the conversation about women, people who are neurodivergent or who learn differently, people who have mental health challenges. We've created a system where we advantage folks who are not just white, but are cisgender, that are heterosexual, that are male, that are able-bodied. There are lots of different layers to the systems of oppression that we're navigating. And I think when we can create authentic relationships where we can talk about that, it moves us away from what you were talking about, Eric, in terms of that woke culture, and gets us back into being into relationship.
Can you share a story or an example, maybe not from you directly, but of how we as white people may not see how the layers of systemic oppression work together to create this disparity? Sometimes privileged white folks don't understand that narrative because it doesn't affect them. They haven't experienced what it's like to be another person.
Yeah. I mean, I naturally am always going to lean into my own experiences because I don't want to talk for anybody else or share someone else's story. And I've got a few of them. But one story that I talk a lot about is, you know, my upbringing. So I, you know, was born in a lower income home. I was raised by a single mom. My grandmother, my aunt, and my mom had to work together in order to get us ahead. You know, my grandmother quit her factory job in order to care for me and my siblings because my mom could not find affordable quality childcare for me and my siblings. And so, you know, all of these systemic challenges these three women navigated. I grew up as a first gen kid in Brooklyn, New York. And at the age of 6 or 7, I vividly remember seeing systems and organizations with wonderful missions that were meant to help and serve us, but often did the opposite. That they organizations and systems that actually created harm and created distrust for people that looked like me and you know, my family. And so fast forward, navigating all of those challenges and getting to achieve the American dream and get out of poverty took both resources in our community to support us, but it also took us having to navigate a lot of systemic racism.
Can you tell us a little bit more about these services that are designed to help and wind up harming. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is connected to how organizations are funded, and we could spend a whole hour on that, Eric. Mm-hmm. But there's different grant funding and outcomes that need to be pursued. And if you don't fit this mold in terms of the demographic outlined, or if you're not making progress quickly enough, or folks that are in those helping professions, and I used to be a social worker, so I get it, have high caseloads, you become another number in the system versus having someone that's actually there to support you and help you and your family advance. And so when you go through organization and after organization or system after system, and you're not actually getting ahead, it creates this distrust. And it actually can begin to feel like, and I've seen this both as a recipient of services and as a provider of services, as a social worker, it creates a system where why even engage in those resources and opportunities if they're not actually going to help you get ahead?
One of the things that I think has been going on in healthcare is this issue. And the problem with healthcare is that it's sick care. You go in and you're sick and you're a number and it's okay, treat you, here's your drugs, here's your next step, and you're out the door. Do you feel like the same thing? And I think people trust the health system less because of it. And it's expensive and everyone's in medical debt. Not everyone. So do you think the same kind of thing could be going on in social services or government-provided services where it's not about helping the family progress? It's not about helping children advance. It's about you're here. Okay, great. And you become a number. You become a cog in the wheel.
Yeah. I mean, I want to say this carefully because I think that there's, you know, wonderful people that work in, you know, government and in nonprofit sector that, you know, we're all well intended. I think the intent is to help and serve, but yes, I think because we take a response or reactive approach, it can lead to what you just described. When we talk about racial justice, we talk about transformative justice. And what transformative justice means is actually looking upstream and looking at the system that's created the need in the first place. We spend all of our time as organizations responding to the need, but how do we break the cycle so that the need doesn't exist in the first place? That is true transformative justice.
So how do we do that?
The short answer to that is looking upstream, looking at how we do more of that prevention work, providing folks the resources they need before they need it. Really, you were talking about public health. You know, we've named in Buncombe County racism as a public health crisis. How do we respond to that? Providing more mental health resources, really working with the providers to think more upstream and more proactively in a culturally humble and responsive way. I mean, it's so multi-pronged, but I do think it starts with zooming out and looking at prevention.
What is our society losing through racial injustice? Or what aren't we getting?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're losing a lot. I think we're losing so much that we probably can't even quantify it. But when you look at all the research out there, you could take any topic. You could take gender-based violence. You could take early care and education. You could take health care. You could take immigration. You could take almost any topic. If you look at the resources it would take to do the prevention versus the response, simply from an economic standpoint, we would reduce our spending if we put our energy and our resources into prevention versus response. You talked about the medical, you know, the healthcare system. The reason why there are other countries that provide universal health care, and I don't mean to drop a bomb because I know that can be, you know, politically charged, but the reason why countries provide universal health care is because it's financially advantageous to us. Or to them to provide the preventative care versus the reactive care. And so, you know, to answer your question, I think it's we lose a lot in terms of life expectancy, economically, quality of life. And I think that's the thing that I like to stress a lot with folks in our racial justice workshops and in our conversations is this is not about lifting up BIPOC folks. Though it might sound like it is, it makes us all better. Like none of us are free until we're all free. And we all have something to gain from talking about equity.
when we think about making America great, which we may not be thinking about, but it seems to me there's a piece of this where we're losing productivity. We're not just spending money, but it feels like we're also losing a valuable asset.
Yes.
By marginalizing people and keeping them from being their best selves.
Absolutely. I mean, from an employment standpoint, if you look at diversity, equity, inclusion research, companies that promote true diversity of thought, empowerment to challenge the decisions that are made, not just equity by race, but gender, age, thought, background, those companies are more successful that really cultivate an organizational culture that promotes and supports that. So there is a bottom line dollar economic consideration that we need to evaluate.
So I'm smiling and laughing because I always hear people say, well, America should be run like a business. And if it was, we would want our people to be as productive as possible.
Yes.
And we don't. And a lot of times the same people who are criticizing America for not being run like a business are the same folks who aren't supporting racial justice, or they're not supporting equality or economic opportunity for folks. And I just think it's an ironic situation because it seems like just what you're saying is true. Why would we spend so much money on systems that actually lead to more crime and higher healthcare costs and all these other things, and those folks are not as productive? Why would we want to perpetuate that? That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, again, I want to assume positive intentions for folks that kind of fall into that trap in terms of thinking. It is a little short-sighted, in my opinion, and it's not looking at the intricate web of what we lose and what we could gain if we approached it differently.
I know, to me, one of the things is so many people seem to have this concept that there's a fixed amount of pie that's available. And if I give you, anything I give to you means I have less. And I think what Eric was saying before, if we all work together, there's going to just be more pie.
Yeah, we're going to have way more food at the table. And you know what? The food's going to taste better because a lot more people are going to be making it, right? Like, when we talk about equity, you know, it's not bringing someone down to size so that someone else can be elevated. Again, it's looking at, one, what happened historically that this person has so much more than somebody else? How do we repair and try to make that right? And how do we all gain from all having more? So I love that you named that.
Yeah, I do too. I think that's great. It's not a pie.
No, you know? that is, you know, we talk about this in the nonprofit sector. We talk about, you know, scarcity versus abundance mindset. And that idea that there's only one pie and there's only a finite amount, that's rooted in scarcity. And I want to encourage each individual listening to this to challenge that way of thinking. There is plenty to go around.
What are some solutions that people can do today, whether it's a mindset change or whether it's a physical action? And also, can we change policies? Can business think about things differently? Because you mentioned, you know, business, a good business is going to be open to all kinds of people.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. Three quick responses to that. One is, again, as I was talking about how we define what it means to be an anti-racist, it starts with us. So it starts with educating ourselves, exposing ourselves to different content and information that challenges us, makes us think, and allows us to analyze and self-reflect on our own prejudices and what that looks like. Being a person that can be given feedback on how we show up in the world, being open to being wrong, all of that is part of our own individual work. The second thing that I want to name is, yes, loads of opportunity to do advocacy work. The YWCA has an advocacy committee that's open to the community if anybody is interested in that. We meet monthly. We promote 7 different priorities: racial justice, civil rights, gender-based violence, early care and education, equal pay and workplace fairness, healthcare, and immigration. We're just one of many organizations here in Asheville that are doing lots of wonderful advocacy work, and we do work in partnership with those other organizations. And lastly, yeah, if you're a business owner or you are in a leadership role, looking at the policies and practices that your business or your organization or your group or team or congregation are utilizing to operate and to do whatever scope of work you are responsible for is a part of the critical analysis that does create change. something as small as how we review a resume, where we post our job descriptions for hiring, who's on your hiring team. Like, all of those things can be assessed and analyzed in a way that creates more equitable opportunities for those who are interacting with us and our organizations.
Do you think policies need to change?
Absolutely, yes.
What are a handful of policies that folks should be thinking about?
You know, something that we're actively doing a fair amount of advocacy around is around what supports are provided for our childcare, our early childcare education system. That is a system that is a failing system nationally and lacks a pipeline for educators. That's something that at the state level we could advocate for more funding for, increasing the supports and educational opportunities for people who want to get into that industry as educators. Looking at housing, you know, we know that Asheville and Buncombe County has been ravished by gentrification, and we have a long history that's impacted our housing that started with urban renewal and redlining that we haven't even gotten into in this hour, which I'm really passionate about, that we're still having to reconcile. There's advocacy we can do at the local level, city and county level, around reparations and what resources can be provided to the BIPOC community that have been impacted generations back. So yes, policy needs to change city, state, and nationally.
How would you encourage the media and folks to think about the media, even social media, because I think that's taking over as media. How can people participate and advocate for an opportunity for everybody?
I think this is a great example of it, being able to have conversations that are outside of political affiliation and really just look at the issues. Any opportunity we can bring the energy level down in terms of rhetoric, really shedding light on the human experience. I also think, you know, when we talk about social media, whether it's the actual platform or the folks engaging in those platforms, really coming from a standpoint of trying to learn versus debate. When we come from a stance of debate, we're not actually advancing anybody's learning. We're just kind of staying stuck in our own positions. So how do we create safeguards? How can media and social media create some safeguards where we can come from it from more of a place of dialogue?
How do you help people get to that dialogue by being unafraid of being wrong?
I think it starts by modeling it and being a person that can share about ways in which they've missed the mark. I try to do that. I try to model that both professionally and personally. I also think it's around setting boundaries. We define boundaries as the ability to love yourself and others at the same time. So how do you hold both? How do you respect what journey you're on and the journey that the person sitting across from you is on, and allow there to be a fluid conversation around when we've missed the mark?
Have you ever seen a situation where maybe you have, maybe it's a group setting, maybe it's a one-on-one conversation, don't know, where you have a white privileged person, stereotypically, and then maybe you've got a group of people who represent different perspectives in LGBT or BIPOC, and interact and actually see minds change, and what does that look like?
Yeah. Yes. I get to see that a lot in our racial justice workshops, because it's not all lecture. So an example that comes to mind, to keep it brief, was a black woman was sharing an experience of racism, because we actually share examples of interpersonal racism. And a white woman said something like, "I'm so sorry for you." You know, she said something along that line. And the black woman said, I don't need you to feel sorry for me. And they both kind of walked away from the conversation. And at the end, you know, at the end of that session, we were able to debrief it. And it was this wonderful exchange of the BIPOC woman being able to say, "That feels patronizing when you say that. I don't need you to feel sorry for me. I need you to just sit with me and not try to fix it." And the white woman was able to say, "Thank you for sharing that with me. This was my intention." So she was able to offer some clarification, and she was able to say what she would do differently next time. And she thanked the black woman for the feedback. And so even that small exchange was that mindset shift for all of us in that room, in that Zoom room. And that comes with being in proximity and being willing to have the conversation. Both of them were brave in that moment.
So both were brave. And I feel like that's what it's going to take for folks. And I really appreciate how throughout the whole show, you've not complained at all. You know, it just shows that, and this is kind of the purpose of the show, is people come to things with positive intent.
Yes.
And a lot of times we think that they don't. And the way to break down these barriers, it sounds like you're saying, and this is a great example, is have the conversation with an open mind and positive intent, because people aren't out to get, there may seem like some people are, but in general, if you assume positive intent, it can open up your thinking and your mind to be exposed to these new ideas.
Absolutely. And we don't know what we don't know. Right. And so, no, I completely agree. Assuming a positive intent and slowing down enough to simply have the conversation and ask the question, hey, did you mean this when you said that? Because this is how I heard it. Right. Like that's communication.
Well, folks, we have to run. But Diana, thank you so much for coming in. This has been great and just a fantastic. You're doing great work. And I hope our listeners learn something today about how to tackle racial injustice in a really productive and healthy way. And it doesn't have to be through policy. It just has to be through being an open-minded, good person and listening to other people. Thanks a lot, everybody, and have a great day.
Thank you.
When the groom saw people passing notes, not unusual, he might say, but where are the flowers for my baby? I'd even like to see her mean old mama. And why ain't there a funeral if you're gonna act that way? Traces of old lies still on their faces. So why don't someone here just spike his drink? Why don't you do him in some old way? Supposed to be a funeral. It's been a bad, bad day. Child. supposed to be a funeral. It's been a bad, bad day. Oh, it's supposed to be a funeral. It's been a bad, bad day.
And you are listening to Asheville FM, WSM.
Good morning, Jackie. Hold on.
Give her a read the ID.
Hi, you're listening to Asheville FM at 103.3 here in Asheville, North Carolina. We're glad to have you here on the Dreamers and Doers show. And we are looking forward to having...
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I don't hear that we're on air either, to be honest.
Yeah, we're good.
Oh, okay. Anyway, this is Dreamers and Doers. This is the show that brings you every week somebody in our... Oh, entrepreneurial community, or in our social services community, or artists who are here and happy to share with you their story, their progress, and who they are, what they do.
And see if they can hear us.
What?
See if they can hear us.
Hi, can you hear? Good morning, Jackie. Do you hear me? She says she does. We're doing a Zoom call this morning, and we unfortunately have to make a little change here. Jackie, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, Jackie, we got you.
Right, here we are.
for future reference, anybody who's interested in doing a Zoom call at the station, it is PS1 that we use. Anyway, good morning.